Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
One, two, three, four!
Welcome to the Iditapod.
A podcast about what else the Iditarod.
We are a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM in Nome. I'm your host, Casey Grove.
And I'm your reporter along the trail now in Nome, Alaska, Zachariah Hughes.
Before we make our final push to the finish, here's a word from our sponsor.
Support for Iditapod 2018 comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
Well, thanks for joining me, Zach. How's Nome been?
Nome's great. I haven't been here that long because, as we have discussed privately and in very angry G-chats back and forth, I was stuck in Koyuk for a little while. So I got to Nome yesterday under bright blue skies, which felt like it added a little bit of insult to injury. It was the coldest it's been the entire trail. When I landed, it was one below,
wow,
which was fine. It was just kind of crazy when the whole trail is in the tens and 20s and maybe single digits a night here and there. And then you get to Nome and it's kind of a little chillier.
Clear and cold, though.
Clear and cold. But right now it's like super low visibility. There's like a dense ice fog or something that's moved in. And I heard some planes landing, but it's soupy out there.
Huh. You got that window to get out of Koyuk and into there, though. That's good. So you're in Nome and there's mushers that are still finishing the race. There's like 38, maybe we're down to like 36 mushers still out on the trail. But describe the scene for me in Nome as they finish. There's like a siren that goes off. How does that all go down?
Yeah, there's a lot of participation around Nome. So a siren goes off when mushers come up off the ice or are kind of approaching the finish line. Mushers, the race route goes along the sea ice, and then there's a certain point just down the street from the finish line where it goes up this big ramp and pops through like a building alley and then ends up on Front Street in Nome, which looks like a normal city street. And there's a big kind of ribbon of snow that the city's brought in for mushers to travel down the last few blocks until they arrive in a big built-up snow kind of ramp in the middle of a street that's closed off on both sides under the Burled Arch. So it's really kind of very front and center. And when mushers get in, there's somebody there announcing to welcome them and greet them. The Iditarod volunteers hole up in the mini convention center, which is kind of like a big race headquarters central, and they'll come out and greet the musher, take their information in. There's a PA system, so all the stuff is kind of blaring out at all hours of the day and night, and they say who it is and how many dogs, and the musher feeds their dogs, and there's varying degrees of the press corps that's present. A lot of the media crews leave after the first musher or the top, you know, maybe 5 or 10. KNOM here in Nome covers the first, the top 20. And actually they were out for Hugh Neff this morning covering the 21st. And then there's also friends and family that are there greeting people, hugging, saying hello, welcoming them, handlers taking dogs and helping out. So very big scene. Mayor Richard Benville comes for, I think, almost every musher and just personally greets them and kind of gives a show and a big performance of saying hello and welcoming them to Nome. So I will say the later mushers who get in do not get the same kind of warm welcome, and mushers who arrive at convenient times often have bigger crowds, whether they're just milling about on the street or because it's easier to go to than the people arriving at, you know, 4 a.m.
And there was a pretty big crowd yesterday. Early in the morning, Yor Olsom came in, won the race at 3 a.m. We still have, like I said, quite a few mushers out on the trail. Way in the back, holding up the Red Lantern position right now, is Tara Cicatello and Steve Watkins just a little bit in front of her. They left Caltag this morning. It sounds like Rob Cook scratched in Caltag. And the mushers have been dealing with a real tough trail this year, it sounds like. Olsom's win was one of the slowest winning times in recent memory, and it was only about half an hour faster than his rookie year in 2013. So we saw Nicholas Petit come in second, and defending champ Mitch Seavey came in third. It sounds like the KNOM guys got some tape of him, and there was some that you might want to share with us.
Yeah, Mitch Seavey gave a great interview in the race shoot. He, I can say from personal experience, is not always the most talkative or generous interviewee along the trail, something that he kind of jokingly acknowledged in his race interview when he thanked volunteers, he thanked Iditarod officials, he even thanked the media, sort of paused for a beat and then explained that he'd told most of the people around him at some point, asked them to get out of his face at checkpoints. But Mitch was in really high spirits. And the first piece of tape I pulled from that was just him explaining a little bit about how hard the trail was in terms that I think are really illustrative. So this is Mitch explaining what the run into Nome along the Bering Sea coast was like for him and his team.
A lot of the trail was not a trail. There was just markers every now and then, or what trail was there was blown over, or it would be really soft. The leaders have to be just incredibly tough and determined, mentally tough. One of the things that you don't recognize on a trail like that, but you get going on a good stretch and then suddenly you hit a big drift and it's just face plants and belly flops, and it's really hard to manage that. And the dogs have to be smart and be tough. So you can't go too fast even when the trail is good because it might drop out from under them right there. So
that's been a real consistent theme throughout this Iditarod, was how tough of a trail it was. And that doesn't just mean, you know, inclement weather raining down, but really the physical condition of where mushers ought to be running. And with deep snow, the dogs have to work a lot harder. They've got to lift their legs. That's something that for Mitch's team was a real problem later on. And he explained in Unalakleet and elsewhere that his dogs weren't used to running in snow that deep. It affected their hindquarters. His team are lopers, so they kind of rock when they run, and exerted more energy from them in the deeper snow. But it also just means inconsistencies that the dogs are trying to cope with, and it slows down speeds. It affects the dogs' kind of consistency and ability to harmonize in their runs if there's uneven conditions. And that was not just true on the coast. That was true on the Yukon when fresh snow was falling and mushers were dealing with that, with windy conditions that blew out sections of the trail. So it was a much longer race this year than the record-setting pace last year. I mean, we were, I think, like a day and a half behind last year's race. And there's some really good reasons for that that have to do with the routing. But also, it was just a tough conditions for dogs to run in.
And Mitch talked about it being kind of tough on him, too, right?
Yes. The dogs were not the only ones that had a hard time this year. Mitch sort of jokingly offered up in his interview how he was physically doing. So here's that.
You know, I've seen in some movies where they say they get to the point where it doesn't hurt anymore. They're almost dead or something. Not quite that bad, but it doesn't hurt anymore.
Mitch, definitely one of the older, more established mushers in that top pack there, finishing in third. What did you hear in that tape?
I heard him saying with a laugh what I heard him through a lot of the trail saying through gritted teeth to race officials and vets and even his son in Unalakleet, Danny Seavey, who was there and on hand and kind of said hello to his dad. Mitch was having a really tough time physically. His back was really hurting him. He was not able to keep up and run alongside the sled like he's done in some years or to help out his team. And it took a toll, and that affects your race. It affects how quickly you can do your chores. When I saw him in Unalakleet, he was just slower going up and down his dog line than he has been in past years. And I think on a trail like this that's very physically demanding, there maybe is a little bit of a youth advantage. One of the things Mitch said in that final interview was that last year, his record-setting run, the trail was fast and smooth, and he really just stood on the runners. He didn't have to work very hard to add capacity to his team. This year, he was jumping on and off, but it was to keep the sled from tipping over or helping push it through snowdrifts. So it was a very dynamic year, but it wasn't dynamism that was adding to speed. It was dynamism just to keep stuff from going wrong. So a very physical run for him, but not in a good way.
Kind of the traditionally tough Iditarods of the years past. And I think it'd be helpful, too, to go back to Nicholas Petit's interview here. He made a wrong turn between Shaktuluk and Koyuk, and that's basically what cost him the race. That's why Olsen was able to slip around him. We've talked about that before, but he also described that in an interview and kind of what happened there in terms of losing the trail.
I looked to the west a little bit, didn't see anything, went east. I got to the place on the GPS that says there's a trail, but I did loops and there's no trail where there's a trail on the GPS. So then I turned them around, jeeted him around and potted him around and went back where the same direction I came from, just still looking for a trail.
So as we mentioned, Yor Olsson finishing in first, taking his first Iditarod championship. We had Nicholas Petit in second and Mitch Seavey, the defending champ, coming in third. And you would think that Mitch would be maybe kind of upset about falling back a couple positions from last year. Has won the race three times, was going for his fourth championship. But that's not exactly how he described it after finishing in Nome, right?
No, he was very collegial when he came in and explained that, you know, at a lot of the checkpoints he was getting to see the other guys and that forged a little bit of a bond.
That was nice, and I got to talk with Nick some, and of course you are, and you know, I think we're all better friends than ever after having competed as hard as we possibly could against each other. So that's how it works out on the trail.
It's interesting to hear that. I mean, the three of them were close together for a lot of the race going into the checkpoints, and you know, Mitch, you'd think being tired and just having run another 1,000-mile race, he'd be kind of more, you'd think he would kind of maybe have more of a chip on his shoulder.
I think by the time people get to Nome, they're just so ready to be done with everything that there's just a lot of relief. And you get in the race shoot, I think, a much more idealized version of people's races than how they were expressing it in White Mountain or Unalakleet or some of those checkpoints. People tend to be a lot more magnanimous and sentimental about how things went. They'll talk in very grandiose terms about the race and their experience, and a lot of the gritty, really, there's not a lot of curse words in the race shoot, we'll put it that way. And I can't say that for all of the other checkpoints towards the end of the race. So I think what's interesting to me about that too is I cannot imagine personality types more different than Mitch Seavey and Nicholas Petit, and Yor is also very different from them. But Mitch is very routine oriented, very systematic, very disciplined. Nick takes pride in mushing on the fly and reading his dogs on the fly and being unconventional and being sort of feeling things out as he goes. And whereas Mitch really, I think, has expressed a degree of confidence in keeping his dogs at a reduced speed and being able to harness and hold their power, Nick will brag about how fast his team can go and how fast they are on different stretches of the trail. So I really wish I could have been a fly on the wall or a fly on the ice at some of these checkpoints where those guys were talking to each other without any interruption and just musher to musher, because I would be super curious how they talk to one another and what they're saying. But I think Mitch has a lot of respect for the two guys that won ahead of him this year.
Just to round out the top 10 here, we had in fourth place Ray Reddington Jr., fifth place Pete Kaiser, sixth place Richie Deal, seventh place Jesse Holmes, a top rookie in the race this year, in eighth Ramey Smith, ninth Travis Beals, and in 10th Linwood Fiedler. But I want to go back to Jesse Holmes. He looks like he's going to win Rookie of the Year. What did you see from him this year, and did he talk to reporters much in Nome?
I don't think if there's a reporter around, Jesse Holmes can not talk to them. He's definitely somebody who's very forthcoming and very willing to participate in questions and attention. Not in a bad way. He's
a reality TV star.
Yeah, I mean, he's very charismatic. He's insightful. He can just talk in long sentences off the cuff. I enjoy talking with him. He's definitely a performer. And I want to go back a little bit before Nome. I did a really long interview with Jesse at the Iditarod checkpoint where he was taking his 24, and he was way out ahead of Matt Hall and all the other rookies, and things looked really good. And he talked about that a lot. He was very confident, you know, discussing how good his dogs looked, how well they're doing, how great the race was going. And after Iditarod and after that checkpoint, I didn't see Jesse again. Matt Hall overtook him as, you know, another prominent rookie. He really wasn't in that front pack. He really dropped behind. And then he surged up the coast, and he leapfrogged, I think, seven people on the Bering Sea coast and passed seven teams. His dogs really picked up. He had some really fast run times. And I don't want to say he came out of nowhere, because people were looking at him, a Kobuk 440 champion, as somebody who's known to be a very good musher. People had their eye on him. But when he dropped off, I won't speak for too many other people, but we really stopped discussing Jesse Holmes in that top figure. And then for him to end up in seventh as a rookie is no small feat. And he explained a little bit in the race shoot about what happened with his team that there was that giant lag and then that surge at the end.
But you just got to really pace yourself for 1,000 miles and, you know, read the dogs. I spent a lot of time resting because they weren't feeling so good at first. They had a stomach bug, and that ended up paying off in the end. The last few days have been nothing but hang on.
Nothing but hanging on, huh?
Yeah, just pedal to the metal.
And Matt Hall, former Quest champion, so not a rookie to 1,000-mile races, but he came in 11th. Jesse beat him to that Rookie of the Year. Anything else that stood out to you?
I remember feeling this way last year and the year before that. Even in a slower race year like this one, we're seeing this incredible compression among the top 20 and 30 mushers, where not only is the first person to Nome doing it faster and faster and setting these really aggressive paces, but so is everybody behind them. Last year was a little bit of an anomaly with Mitch arriving pretty far in advance of people, but everybody after that is really piled up and really stacked up. And that was true this year too. It feels like not only are there some super competitors that are pushing the upper boundaries of this race, but that everybody is keeping up with that. That you've got these increasingly aggressive race fields where any of these guys and gals in the top 20 or 30 would have been in the top 5, you know, 10, 15 years ago. It blew me away at the Anvik checkpoint earlier this year when a bunch of mushers had taken their eights, their mandatory Yukon eights in Shagaluk, and then people just blasted through Anvik, and it was every 5 minutes there were these hyper-focused mushers with really good-looking teams, super driven, just blasting through, and it just felt like there was no slack even that far, that many hundreds of miles back along the Yukon. Everybody from the first musher in through the 20th and 25th that I was on hand for was just pushing, and that stands out every year, but it's equally true this year, even though we're maybe a day and a half slower than a faster race. Everybody's race is faster relative to previous orders.
It is interesting how you used to see kind of this group of like guys and gals who were the what you would consider maybe more like professional mushers on down to the amateurs, and there was definitely a bigger spread in terms of how fast people were. And now you see just a ton of mushers making it there quickly relative to the trail conditions and the weather, but definitely a lot of faster mushers, a lot of more maybe what you would call professional mushers. And you and I, we are professional reporters. I thought that we'd be able to handle this. We had a few questions left here, and I thought we'd just go through them sort of rapid fire to get them rolled out here. Are you ready?
I am present.
That's good enough. All right, question number one here in our rapid fire round comes from Joe Snodgrass at Comanche Middle School in Iowa. His teacher is actually the 2015 Teacher on the Trail, Aaron Montgomery. We talked about the Teacher on the Trail program in a past question and answer. They also are doing a Husky Talk podcast, and that kind of goes into the realm of student-run podcasts like the Aikidapod.
The burgeoning genre of mushing podcasts that are soon going to overtake the Apple top charts. We're part of a trend, my friend.
I feel old compared to them, and I also feel a little nervous that they're coming up behind us with these very competitive podcasts, Husky Talk and the Aikidapod. But here is Joe Snodgrass's question. How fast do the dogs run?
Fast. Specifically, actually, we have Mitch Seavey talking about that from this year.
Roll the tape.
I don't think I've gone that slow with a dog team in 15 years. We've been training to go faster and faster, and suddenly 6 miles an hour was the norm, and I had a hard time getting my head around that it's okay to go 6 miles an hour, but the dogs were happy with it. They were fine, so it worked out.
Mr. Joe Snodgrass, that's not the lower level on a slower year like this one. 6 miles per hour, dogs will kind of keep up an average speed like that. In faster years, it's closer to 8, 9, 10 miles per hour that they're able to sustain on some of the faster parts of the trail. And then occasionally mushers will just open them up and let the dogs run, and they'll pull even faster than that. You know, I think getting into 12, 13 miles an hour for stretches, they can go faster, but it's hard for them to sustain much faster than that when it's not a kind of brief sprint.
And you've said this before, but it's kind of surprising sometimes how the mushers put a lot of effort into actually slowing them down to make sure the dogs don't kind of run themselves out of energy early on in the race. And then you've got sprint races where they go even faster because they don't have as far to go. So let's go on to Jennifer in Ontario. She sent us a question kind of comparing the Iditarod to the Tour de France, which is a stage race. It's a little different. And she's wondering, kind of saying that the Tour de France cyclists, they've got race managers and people giving them massages at the end of those stages. How does that compare to the Iditarod? Are there people in the checkpoints helping the mushers, giving them tips on how the competition's doing, what the weather's going to do, and just how alone are they out there, either on the trail or in the checkpoints?
I don't know anything about this French bicycling race that has been mentioned, but I can tell you with the Iditarod, they have to be doing everything pretty much alone. It's an unassisted race, which is different from the Yukon Quest, where handlers can kind of help out at checkpoints. Mushers are really expected to do pretty much everything alone, everything from dog care to being out on the runners in the middle of the night all on their own. There's some assistance in the form of, you know, somebody might bring you hot water at some of the checkpoints, but you've got to make your own food. The vets might come over and inspect your dogs, but mushers are the ones taking their booties off, taking their harnesses off. It's designed to be a self-sufficient race, even though there's a lot of buffering on the sides to kind of help smooth that along in certain places.
And I've got to issue just a slight correction here. The handlers in the Yukon Quest are actually only allowed to help in Dawson, where there's a mandatory 24-hour rest. But the Yukon Quest does run a lot along highways, unlike the Iditarod, so handlers can talk to the mushers in those places and kind of give them a rundown of how the competition's doing and what the weather's doing. And you see that a lot in the Quest. They kind of offer them tips and advice along the way. And in the Iditarod, it's just between the checkpoints, you're just, for the most part, completely out in the wilderness, and handlers and friends and family have a hard time flying into those checkpoints. So it's not like you can just stop and talk to them along the way.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier that you know, Danny Seavey was on hand in Unalakleet and said hi to his dad. That's very rare. Families and supporters are not usually at many checkpoints, and when they are, many of them take great pains not to appear like they're coaching or interfering or offering information. You know, they can't provide outside assistance, and that includes, you know, trading information and stuff. Of course, there's a little bit of, you know, how are your dogs? How'd so-and-so's dogs look? Things like that, people searching out for more information. But generally, the people who are super competitive know the rules well enough, and they don't want to sabotage themselves with something like that. And the people that are getting out to checkpoints to see their mushers, see their family members, their significant others, their dads, what have you, a lot of them are doing it on snow machine. They're doing it on bush planes. It's not like they're just dropping in as part of a strategy. It's really kind of trying to keep up and just say hello and maybe provide a little bit of moral support or a boost.
And on to our next question. It comes from Lukey Gail Tobin. She asked, what is the deal with trail mail? Well, I did a little research today, and I don't think I have the entire answer, but it harkens back to the days when dog mushers carried mail for the U.S. Postal Service, even, on the trails that we've been talking about. And that's how the mail got to different mining camps. I think you know a little bit more about that. But the part where it relates to the Iditarod today is that it's part of the Iditarod's educational program. And basically, students send letters to the educational program. Those are put into cachets, I will say, little bundles of mail. And the mushers carry that from Anchorage all the way to Nome. Well, I've got a question here, and it has to do with the race purse. We have heard that it's $500,000 this year, and there's a breakdown among the top teams in terms of how much each musher gets. How much do you know about that? What's the breakdown? And I guess we don't really know until the musher's banquet on Sunday how much each musher gets.
The Iditarod announced earlier back in the fall that they were going to have to reduce the overall size of the purse to $500,000. That's down quite a bit, I think about $250,000 from what it was. You know, the musher who makes it into Nome first gets the most money. They get the biggest check, they get a truck, but the top 30 mushers are pretty well compensated, and the steps down are not enormous. So I'm just looking at the 2017 Iditarod purse results. And so Mitch Seavey got $71,000 The next person down, Dallas EV, got about $60,000. After that, the steps down are about $5,000, and then they get reduced even more, so that by the time you're at the 30th musher, who in 2017 was Cody Strath, it was almost $2,000. After that, everybody gets about $1,000 as a matter of course. This year, Yor Olsson will get $50,000, so a big step down from recent years, with the Iditarod having to cut back its purse, and we can figure that the people next down from that will take a couple of $1,000 less each. I have to say that I was looking back, and until the late 90s, for most of the races early, you know, two decades, a little bit more, everybody, the winner just got $20,000. It was just flat. It was $20,000 going way back, and then it was $20,000 up to the mid-90s, you know, inflation be darned. So it really has been a sort of like last two decades thing that the purse would go way high and there'd be all this sort of talk about how much it was. It used to just be a flat $20,000 for decades.
It'd be interesting to see if they go back to kind of a flat amount or what. And the sort of the lower placing teams, that money kind of just helps them keep going. It helps them recoup their costs. Probably not all of their costs, but it definitely helps to get a couple thousand bucks.
And a big difference this year from last year with that smaller race purse was that instead of compensating the top 30 mushers, Iditarod said they're only going to compensate the top 20 mushers.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Well, so they get that for crossing the finish line. Of course, that is the Burled Arch. You got a question about that from somebody special. Who was that and what was their question?
My girlfriend, Penny Gage, who is probably the biggest booster of the Iditapod out there. And she asked when we were talking on the phone the other day, like, what is the Burled Arch? I know you guys, I've heard you say it so many times, and I just don't, what is it? Is it a real thing? And I was kind of like, oh, right, this weird thing. I don't know the history, but the Burled Arch itself is a cross-section of a tree, a big tree, with a ton of burls on it. It's not really an arch. At best, it's kind of like a wooden portal. And I don't know why it's there. It's just the big wooden finish line that just sits there at the end of the ice chute. Do you know why it's there?
Yeah, I had to look this up though, and it was very informative. I mean, you're right. We kind of just throw this out like they cross under the Burled Arch, and then we don't really explain what the Burled Arch is. So it goes back to some of the earliest races. Of course, the first Iditarod in 1973. And what I read was that when the first musher was about to arrive in Nome, somebody made some Kool-Aid and like drizzled it across the street to mark the finish line. And then in the second Iditarod, the last two mushers came across. This is the second to last, and the last being the Red Lantern. And one had a paper plate that said "the" on it. And the last musher, Red Fox Olsson, had a paper plate that said "end" on it, so "the end." But this guy, Fox Olsson, who I want to add, finished the race in 29 days, 6 hours, 36 minutes, and 19 seconds. So he was out on the track for almost a month. Yeah. That's how long it used to take some of the slower teams back in the day. So he pulls in with the Red Lantern finish in 1974, and he was kind of disappointed that there wasn't anything there to mark the finish line. So he decided he was going to do something about this. And this guy was a gold miner in Fox, Alaska, which is like down the street from my old house in Fairbanks. He went out to Rosie Creek, a different part of Fairbanks, and he found this burled tree, and that was the original Burled Arch. With the help of the Lions Club out there, he got this thing down, spent something like 500 hours shaping the log and getting an inscription routed into it. And it weighed something like 5,000 pounds. They airlifted this to Nome and actually fundraised to get the money together to do that. So they had the original Burled Arch up in 1975, and the very first musher to cross underneath it was Ruby's Emmett Peters, who won the 1975 Iditarod. And there had been some repairs along the way. As you know, the climate in Nome can be kind of harsh, and there's the sea right out there, so the salt air is not very good to that arch, and it began to deteriorate over the years. They had done things like glue it and epoxy it to kind of fill the cracks, but then in 1999, a forklift was carrying it over to near City Hall where it stays, and people visiting Nome can go take pictures with the Burled Arch. but this forklift was carrying it and it kind of hit a bump and it cracked and broke the burled arch. So they repaired that, and the information that I have says that it's hanging in the Nome Recreation Center right now. But they made a new arch, and they found a burled log actually in Hope, which is a little closer to Anchorage here, had that donated to the Iditarod, and some community members from Hope put that together. A guy named Bob Kuiper of Alaska Wildwoods volunteered to carve it, and they got that in place in time for the 2000 Iditarod. And the new arch says, end of the Iditarod sled dog race. So there you go.
One of my favorite things about the burled arch is that when it's not Iditarod season, like you mentioned, it just sort of sits around town. It's just like out, yeah. like it couldn't even be bothered to be stored very far away. So it's just kind of like a few feet from where it is during the Iditarod. And for most of the year, it just hangs out there. It's kind of funny to see it in the middle of summer. Just like, welcome to Nome. But just this weird gnarled piece of wood.
I really like how this guy that finished the race in like almost a month decided that there needed to be something better there and went out and found it. And now that's it. That's the traditional end of the Iditarod Trail sled dog race, is the burled arch, because this guy found a burled tree to make the finish line out of.
What is a tradition, but something that you've done more than once?
Just randomly.
Just right? Anything that's happened more than one time is a tradition.
Well, Zach, we have literally reached the finish line, and the finish line for us on these daily episodes of the Iditapod. We'll be back at some point next week to wrap it all up. Not quite sure what form that last episode will take, but we will be back. And as always, you can still find us on iTunes and other podcatcher apps, and maybe you want to go back and relive the race through this coverage. You can listen online at alaskapublic.org and check out the rest of our Iditarod coverage. There are more stories, more photos you can find there. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. I'm Casey Grove.
And I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Until next time, happy trails. And then we'll say, welcome to the Iditapod, okay?
Okay.
All right. 3, 2, 1, and welcome to the Iditapod.
Welcome to the Iditapod.
Goofy. All right, I'm hitting stop.
Bye.